So, far away, anything you want to ask me? Or quarrel with me?
I'd like to ask you something. I wonder if you could expand on the concept of enlightenment, not being individual but being relational, and how an individual attempts to be.
An individual who's on a journey,
hopefully on a journey to manage difficult relations with people who aren't, expand a bit.
Perhaps. Right. Well, let me take the second part of the question and then see if that leads to the first. So the difficult problem of relations with people who are not, at least apparently or explicitly, on such a journey. So that's. Yes, I think that's probably a problem that many people will be familiar with as you begin to be interested in the Dhamma or in conscious evolution. You experience quite a big gap with some people who've been quite close to you or been your friends, maybe with family, and that can be very, very difficult indeed. And I can't really say more than that. It can be very difficult. I think that, as a human being, you need friendship. You need a context. You need a human context. And the people will do almost anything for a human context. Again, it's one of the themes that comes out of this Hungarian book, My Happy Days in Hell, that people in those concentration camps would betray their souls for some sort of context or contact. Humanity, human relations. It's a desperate need. It's, we're built as relational beings, and what we generally recommend, and what we've all found, if we've been at it at all, is that we need sangha. We need some contact with people who share our aspirations and who will understand what you're talking about. You know that I don't know whether you've had this experience. I remember living in a sort of student community type flat and going on a retreat. And, my eyes had really been opened by that. I'd seen something that I'd not seen before. I was probably a bit insufferable about it. But I just remember the absolute incomprehension of people. They just couldn't really understand what I was on about. It's quite a lonely sort of feeling. But fortunately, I also found on that retreat people who I did relate to in that sort of way and had good relations with. So I think you need to make sure that you have got connections with people with a really who share your aspirations or your interests in this respect and who understand what you're talking about, understand what you're going through. I was talking to one of the community members upstairs who is a psychologist. One of the things he's finding is that people have often very powerful and unusual experiences which are then pathologized. They're told they're mentally ill. But actually what's happening is very much out of the ordinary and quite powerful, but it really... Anybody with some sort of idea of a path can see that there's something of a different nature going on. But people who don't see things in that way will pathologize it. They'll just see that it's something wrong. So, yes, you need people who don't dismiss what you're on about and who understand what your interests are and who share them. And I think if you've got that, your relations with those who don't become easier. If you see what I mean, you can accept them for what they are. My parents never really understood or accepted what I was on about, and to begin with, that created all sorts of tensions, and I was pretty unpleasant about it at times, to be frank. Mind you, I got as good as I gave at times. My mother was a pretty feisty woman, that sort of, when the heat went out of that, when I had real spiritual friends who I could share that with, well, I could accept that relationship with my mother for what it was, my father for what it was. You know, at times openings did occur and we did seem to understand each other more deeply. But I think the most important thing is to make sure there are people who share your aspiration. And then I think everything else takes its place. And of course, in time, you can begin to find ways of communicating the Dharma yourself. And hopefully that will reach people you care about who are resistant to it or not interested. Does that help? Is that getting in the right territory?
Yeah, and the first point that I was wondering if you could also
expand upon.
I think you said enlightenment is never individual, it's always relational.
Yes. Well, there's quite a lot that one could say about that. I think that, first of all, you could say that although we focus on the enlightenment of the Buddha, maybe he was only able to achieve that because there was a whole background of spiritual movement. This is represented in the Buddhist scriptures, in the quasi-canonical scriptures, in the Jataka stories. So you get stories of the Buddha in previous lives, and at the end of the story, the Buddha will say, well, you know, such and such was me, such and such was you, such and such was so-and-so. Do you see what I mean? So the idea being that these people had been practicing, well, an ethical life, practicing a cultural life, practicing even a spiritual life together for a very long time. So that you get an image, not of isolated individuals finding their way on their own, but of a whole culture of uplift. And unfortunately, the way in which the Dhamma is usually talked about, well, we want to stress the individual responsibility element of it, but in doing so we lose, especially because of the highly individualized culture we live in, we lose the context. And yes, the sense you get is that the Buddha became the Buddha under his own efforts, but in the context of a historical culture. I mean, in the sense both of, you know, Indian culture at the time that he was living, and in the sense of some sort of process going on, perhaps involving other lives. You may find that difficult to take on board, but it's interesting. I just saw Sangharakshita the other day, and he said, I can't remember apropos of what, but he said that people had been asking him recently, was he thinking about death? It's a very tactful question to ask somebody who's 86, and particularly somebody who's been practicing Buddhism most of that time. Anyway, he said, well, I always say, no more than usual, which is quite interesting. And then he said, but I have been thinking about rebirth more. And then he said something like, of course I believe in rebirth, and I hope to have a bit of a rest for a while. He said, I hope I'm not reborn for a while. Then he said something like, yes, he sort of didn't feel any attraction to samsara. He felt deeply disgusted by samsara. He didn't mean an emotional disgust, a sort of existential disgust. But he said then, well, that there is the bodhisattva ideal. And so I sort of tried to find out, rather slightly with my tongue in my cheek, where he thought he might be reborn. And he said, first of all, that if it was determined on the law of averages, he presumed there was a strong chance it would be in China, just because there was a lot of Chinese. But he said he thought it probably wasn't determined on that basis. So then, entering into the spirit of it, I said, Bhante, I really want to be reborn with you next time. So he said, well, you might not be long in following me. Okay. Thank you very much. End of conversation. But then he did allude to this sort of idea of groups of a spiritual community sort of persisting across time, which seems to have been a quite traditional point of view in Buddhism, that groups of people become so strongly linked in practicing the Dhamma that they're linked again and again. So you could say, I hadn't expected to say this, but you could say that maybe that's what's one of the points that's in the background of this idea of the relational quality of enlightenment, that yes, he was the one who had to say, I'm leaving you all, I'm not going on with these absurd ascetic practices which only make you thin, I'm going to sort of find my own way, and did stand out. But in a way, given that those five ascetics did gain enlightenment, well, after just a few days of intensive teaching, they must have been fairly highly attuned, and fairly highly attuned to him. So perhaps one could sort of see that there's a spiritual culture, if you like, to put it that way, which maybe is, you could see in simply historical, sociological terms, but maybe you could also see in terms of a larger cosmic context. So that enlightenment arises to some extent in dependence on conditions. Of course, those conditions are substantially to do with the individual's efforts, but the individual's efforts themselves are enabled or prevented by circumstances. There are circumstances today where it's very, very difficult to practice the Dhamma, at least at all seriously. You can see from my reading of this book on the situation in Hungary after the communist takeover in 1947. Really, any independence of thought, any independence of action, impossible. Anybody who showed any sense of higher values was sooner or later a threat and was sent to the camps. And what I see with this author, the poet, probably the greatest poet of Hungary of the 20th century, that he's kept himself spiritually alive in a cultural way. Extremely difficult. You see so many other people corrupted and destroyed by it. So, yes, that's quite an interesting reflection. But then, although clearly the Buddha was driven by his own sense of the inadequacy of his any achieved level of understanding that he might have had. It wasn't just a personal disquiet. It was a strong sense of the vacuity of the life around, and a strong sense that it was not just vacuous for him, it was vacuous for all. You can get those sort of moments where you're walking along the street and you see that the emptiness behind it all, not just the emptiness for you, the sort of emptiness around you. Of course, you don't know what's really going on with individuals, but you kind of get some impression of the sort of living out something that really is quite illusory. And one's urge to find a solution isn't simply a personal one, if you see what I mean. So the quest for enlightenment beyond a certain point isn't really to do with an isolated individuality. It's to do with finding a solution to life itself, the situation. If you said the human situation, that would limit it too much. So the quest itself is relational. We emphasize, individuals emphasize one side or the other, more or less. Some people are much more concerned with their own inner psychological suffering, and some are much more concerned with the social or political or cultural condition of things. But in the end, it's the same thing. They're absolutely interrelated. And the Buddha, presumably, was motivated by both, the point where they intersect. And then after his enlightenment, there was never for him a sense of personal, a merely personal freedom, if you see what I mean. Yes, he was himself no longer subject to the turbulence of the kleshas, the poisonous mental states. They no longer arose with him. He'd broken the self-attachment that they're based upon. But he never lost his relationship. That's what I tried to bring out in my way of recounting the story, you know, his relationship to nature and the world that has sustained him, to the tree, represented by the tree. His relationship to the current system, as represented by his meeting with the Brahmin Huhunkajati. His relationship to sort of something higher values. His relationship to all of humanity. So he never lost that sense. He never became just on his own. And I think this does need bringing out much more. As rightly we stress our own personal responsibility, but that personal responsibility is always exercised in relation. Very interesting. I was thinking about this. There's some discussion about human rights and their position in Buddhism. And it's not a kind of notion that you ever find in traditional Buddhism. And Bhante himself has written a very interesting article a long, long time ago called Rights and Duties, which emphasizes the reciprocal nature of rights and duties, which is a well-known point. But things I've been reading recently suggest that, in a way, the notion of rights, I think rights has been a very valuable constitutional notion. I'm not arguing against that. But it becomes connected with a sort of philosophical perspective, in which rights are sort of intrinsic to you. Things I've been reading recently suggest that Buddhism can come to the same point of view through a different route, which is more regarding the relational quality of human beings in society. So that what you'd need to investigate in discussing the issues that human rights is meant to tackle is that the nature of human relationships and how those can be made truly just. Anyway, that's a larger issue which I won't go into further now. Anyway, does that get you somewhere? But I'm glad you asked that, because it's something that does need spelling out, and I don't think is often spelled out because of our emphasis on the self nature of it. And I think that is absolutely inevitable, because as I've been stressing all this week, karma has to be taken possession of. You have to be responsible for your actions. So that stresses the individual as isolated, although the individual as isolated acting in the world. But I think it gets mixed up with the individualism of the post-enlightenment culture that we live within. And, the radical destructuring of a relational society. When we arrived in the East End in 78, just to set this all up, there was still the remnants of a working-class East End community where everybody knew everybody else, everybody helped everybody else, and it was going extremely rapidly, and where people did feel themselves to be, very much part of a community. It's gone. Probably the Bengalis do, but it's gone. You know, Ilford and the places that people move to, they just move completely out of the old family and neighbourhood contexts. So we live in a much, much more decontextualised world. And we've gained things from that, no doubt. But I think as Buddhists, we need to bring that back to life, because it's only satisfying to us as a human being to be in relationship to others, to have a context, to belong in a positive sense, and to have some influence upon our environment and be influenced by it. So we need to be careful that we don't read into our Buddhist sense of karmic responsibility the possessive individualism of our post-enlightenment society, our capitalist society, if you like. Yeah.
This thinks a lot for the talk. I think it's great, and it's really made me. It's really reflected on kind of what I'm currently involved with at the moment, what I've been feeling, and I've been staying in a tent at St. Paul's since the occupation started, and I felt really inspired.
Yes.
Really driven by it, and we recently just set up a shrine room.
Great. Wonderful.
It's amazing and stuff. But I think I've also struggled a little bit. My place within that, as a Buddhist, and
yes.
as an activist, and I've been an activist for a really long time, and felt I was quite comfortable with that, but also realised that the reasons I did that perhaps weren't with the right view, and been quite angry and not necessarily effective.
Right. Yeah.
But this whole talk has made me think about that, and I was just wondering if you think I felt. Really inspired enough, and there's a lot of different faith groups that are down at the site,
right?
And Buddhist being one, and I was just wondering, like, your view on the true Rattan, and kind of should we involve ourselves in movements like this, or should we have a presence? Or
yes, of course, I don't know very specifically. I haven't been there. I've heard what's said on the news, and I don't pay very much store by that, because you know, I've been the subject of things in the news, and. You know, I didn't recognise myself. In general, I would say we definitely should be involved in activism. Definitely. I am involved in activism. I'm an activist in India. I'm supporting activists in Hungary. I definitely think that we should be, like the Buddha with Huhunkajati, we should be challenging the social order around us, which is always going to be never going to be up to scratch, and it needs people who are demanding of it higher ethical standards, higher human values. So I very much support that sort of activism, and at times I think that activism may have to be very active under certain
circumstances. It's a movement a little bit that, that perhaps we're not grasping that as much.
Mm.
I mean, I might be wrong, but I have some conversation with an old member at West London, kind of just saying a little bit where it, we do focus, which I think is really positive, kind of on reflecting within and stuff.
Well, I think you'll find there are people and people, and there's quite a wide range. And fortunately, this more activist aspect of things is very much alive in some places, in some quarters. So you just need to link up with those people. I don't know the sources, but I'm sure there are very easy ways of making contact with quite a number of people. I can put you in contact with people who are very much interested in this. There may be even some of them down at St. Paul's. I wouldn't be at all surprised. You know, whether that specifically is a good thing to do, I can't say. And you have to do it. Do you know what I mean? You can't take an abstract point of view, and we can't decide as a, you know, in the high command that we will do St. Paul's. You just have to do it. And, you know, sometimes you'll find, I wish I hadn't done that. And sometimes you'll see something unfurling from that is really important and valuable. And I think it's very good to ally yourself with people who, at least to some degree, share your positive aspirations. There may be a point at which they don't. Then you have to either hope that you can influence them, or they may persuade you, or you may decide to part company. But we need to work with people of goodwill. Fortunately, Buddhists are not the only people of goodwill. They're not always of goodwill anyway. But fortunately, there are others trying to change things, and we should ally with them. I think that what Buddhism brings to the table is an unusual depth of clarity about view. I think that's what it really comes down to. We know that in the depths what our construction of reality is based upon, and how it operates and how it acts. And we also have a very high value on emotional positivity and a positive attitude, which, as you point out, often activism is based on fury. Although I think even there can be a sort of positive fury, I have to say. I think you can sometimes be full of a kind of loving hate. It's a dangerous territory, but you know what I mean. You can sometimes feel says that you can see an injustice that demands a certain sort of directness and passion. And you can't just be, oh, they're loving too. You can't do that. So, but in the end, it mustn't be destructive. In the end. I feel this is a very, very important aspect of Buddhist practice. However, I do think it's really important if you're engaging in that sort of activism that you're firmly based in Sangha, that you're firmly based in a spiritual community within which there is clarity about view and there's a strong encouragement and active activation of development of the Brahma Viharas, and that you go into those situations with a loving heart as best you can, which doesn't mean necessarily that you're not highly indignant at the injustices. I very, very, my guru in this respect is Dr. Ambedkar, who really, I think, pulls all these ideas together. And if you haven't done so, I strongly recommend that you educate yourself in Dr. Ambedkar's way of thinking, and you can, Sanghanatha can help you do that. And read Sangharakshita's Ambedkar and Buddhism, which really very carefully shows how Buddhism and social activism, you could say social change, come together. Dr. Ambedkar saw that in the end, social justice, liberty, equality and fraternity, in his, from a Western point of view, slightly quaint phrase, striking a smacking of the French Revolution, how that derives, it's ultimately, these are ultimately spiritual principles, and that only deep sense of morality can fuel this this activism. So I'm very, very pleased indeed that you're down there. I'm very pleased, and I hope that there are other members of Triratna there, and you know, maybe it'll go wrong, I don't know, maybe it'll go right, but you won't find out unless you go, unless you try. And you know, clearly there is a gap has opened up in the system. You know, you get these points, don't you, when the whole thing can't quite hang together. And at the moment, it's you know, been revealed, well, just by the subprime crisis, which has sort of destabilised the whole system. You know, probably, my suspicion is that it will be cobbled together again. But there's an opening when fairly widespread sense of dissatisfaction and questioning. So it's pretty superficial, I'm afraid, and on the whole, based on a rather crude sort of analysis, and you know, it's all the bankers' faults or whatever. Actually, it's everybody's greed. It's not just bankers' greed, it's everybody's greed. It's ultimately the way in which we see the world. And but this opening is there for some questioning, and I think it's very, very good that people are there engaging with that. And I heard the Radio 4 take on it on the way down on Friday last week, and I was sort of struck by the sympathy, actually, that the reporters had. There was a slight tendency to trivialise, but at the same time, clearly a sense of sympathy. And I hope this won't sound terrible, but I'm a regular reader of The Economist. It's best to know you know, the heart of the beast, as it were. And what I've been struck by is that the Economist, which is perhaps the Bible of a liberal market perspective, is pretty sympathetic. It's sort of saying, well, there is something wrong. Of course, they'll put it in terms of systemic rather than of a cultural or spiritual issue. So great, I'm really pleased you're there. I thought somebody would be. And I do think that collectively, at the same time as going on retreat, even more assiduously, if you're in that situation, go on retreat even more. Even more, make sure you're meditating properly. Even more, make sure you understand the Dhamma really clearly. Because by goodness, you need it to get to grips with all that. We see that with our work in India. What we're up against in the whole system, of the caste system, which is now absolutely involved with the, you know, the world economic order. We're up against the most powerful forces, and which are sometimes utterly disgraceful in what they do. But like what I saw in Slovakia, it's disgraceful that human beings are left like that, and that ordinary, decent human beings can park them out there and forget about them. It's disgraceful. So you're up against that, and you need a lot of moral strength and spiritual vision, so you go into it with you know, the right spirit. And I think that's what Buddhists can bring to such a situation. You know, you don't force it, you don't kind of push it down people's throats. So I think I've expressed myself strongly and clearly enough. Dr. Ambedkar, was utterly contemptuous of the Bhikshu Sangha that he experienced at that time. He described it as a huge army of idlers. They're pretty strong terms. They're just sort of obscurantist, isolationist, just looking for a comfortable personal situation, very little real spiritual fire. And, he wanted full-time Buddhists, committed Buddhists, to be active in transforming the world. But he very strongly stressed that, we've got enough burnt-out social workers. We've got enough politicians who lose the plot and simply become, motivated by their own greed or their own, in the quest for power to do good, you become immersed in the quest for power. It's so often the case. So we need to bring Buddhism to bear, and that means you need to have it alive within you. Really, we need stream entrants who are activists. So, well, we need bodhisattvas. That's what we need, bodhisattvas. That's the bodhisattva ideal. So you've got your work cut out. You've both got to change the world and be a bodhisattva in the full sense. Whoever shouts loudest.
Please, first. My question was based around what you said right at the start and right at the end. Because you talked about, you started off talking about how your friends and yourself created this this place. And at the end you talk about recreating the Sangha and re-expressing the Dharma. And my question is really how, but maybe you could start with why. Why you feel like there's this need, and whether or not it's an individual thing or whether it's an institutional thing. Like, why do we need to create institutions?
Well, I first of all said what I said because I'm fairly sure that for many of you it will appear that things are quite worked out and a bit finished. So I wanted to sort of counter that kind of any possibility that you might sense that. Maybe you don't. So that's sort of why I spoke about that. But what did I mean? Well, I suppose it's, in a way it's fairly practical and simple. So at that time, the particular social and cultural and even political situation. And we had to live within that. So at that time, there were large areas of London had been cleared for redevelopment. And, the semi-legal status of squatting left us a wonderful opportunity. So living extremely cheaply, I think I existed on two adult education classes I used to do in the evenings. I was existing on, I think it was £6 a week. Which was a lot of money in those days, before the flood. And we lived in squats. So we set up our first communities in squats. The first centre was an old piano factory that had been cleared for redevelopment. So we used the circumstances of our times to establish the situations that would support our practice. And in dialogue with Bhante, he really formed a way of speaking about the Dhamma. So I meant it quite literally. We need to address our own times and our own culture, our own people. So we didn't have internet. Can you believe it? We didn't have mobile phones. It was even before the days when mobile phones were huge bricks that you carried around with you. There just weren't any. It's a completely different world. And I don't know how you're going to live the Dhamma now. I can tell you principles. I'm very, very good at that. But the practicalities of it, I could probably, if you talk to me about what you're doing, I might be able to open up some possibilities you hadn't seen. I don't understand a lot of it. I just leave that to Sam. So it's just a quite easy, straightforward, practical issue that conditions are very different. I will never completely understand the conditions that you live under, just as you'll never completely understand the ones that I lived under. It was tough. And you have to sort of redevelop how the Dhamma looks now. It's much more difficult to have a business now. It was quite easy in those days. The market has become so sophisticated and so rapidly moving. And it's very clear we've lost all our businesses around here, apart from the Lama's pajamas, which is recent. We've lost them because we didn't move fast enough. Times changed. The certain sort of cafe just didn't work anymore. Certain sort of whole food shop didn't work anymore. Body Wise is on its way out. The whole market has changed. And you need to be really swift if you want to do business. I think we do need to do business. I think people need a working situation where they can live together on the basis of the Dhamma and make money for the Dhamma. So you're going to have to work out what that means today. So I meant it in that sense. But it's something a bit more than that, which is a bit harder to put my finger on. We had certain preoccupations, certain things bothered us. For instance, we still lived very much in the lee of Christianity. We were in the middle of the sexual revolution. Homosexuality was made legal in 1967, which is the time when the movement was founded. The feminist movement was really in its very early stages of a certain phase of it. Of course, the political feminism was much older, but kind of cultural feminism was much newer. It's all fairly well worked through now. I don't think many people know what Christian guilt is anymore, you poor people. You don't know what it is to feel, well, you never would have done, but you never know what it is to live with that sort of sense, which many, many people did. Quite common for people coming into the movement to have a Catholic background in which there's a definite sense of a sort of an oppressive, the squat toad sitting on your head. What am I quoting? I'm quoting something, but I can't remember what it is. It's either Bob Dylan or William Blake, I can't remember. The sense of something sort of oppressive within you that won't let you live out your life. So times are different, and even psyches are different. So it's all going to have to be re-expressed. Fortunately, there's continuity. Because I think my generation did make the decisive breakthrough into a Buddhism in the West. We broke substantially the idea that you had to be a Tibetan, you had to be a Sinhalese, or whatever, that you could be a modern person living in the Western world, which of course is now everywhere. You could be that and be a Buddhist. I think that's what Sangharakshita's decisive contribution was. And we lived that out. So you've got the benefit of that. You're going to have to reinterpret that. Well, with us. It's not an absolute break I'm talking about, but a dialogue And of course, we will resist. You know, because we worked it all out and we got it right. And you young people, you're just sort of, you know, not really respectful and understanding. joking apart, you know what I mean? There's bound to be something of a sort of a mismatch of understanding. Some, you know, very broad-minded people will understand and some won't. And sometimes that'll even be a little bit of a struggle. I've seen that in some centres, that young people want to do something. I'm very aware of this in India, where the generation gap that my generation experienced, where we occupied a completely different culture from our parents. You can see that happening in India. I've seen that with my friends. Their children, you know, smoke the same dope and even listen to, you know, retreadings of the same music. My parents listened to completely different music. They never touched drugs. They thought, and automatically that led to hell. They lived. They still occupied a class system. So, there's going to be more of a continuity than what it was in our times. Does that get you somewhere towards what I mean?
I just want someone to tell me what to do.
Oh. Okay. I'll tell you what to do. Yeah. Well, I think that you can take advantage of the institutions that there are, but as you put yourself into those institutions, you begin to recreate them. So, for instance, you move into a community, should you choose to do so. When you move in, you sort of accept the thing as it were, the way it is. And, you know, they've always done it this way, and you fit in with that. But after a while, you're an equal member of the community, and your voice starts to be heard. And as your voice is heard, it makes some change to the way it works. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But so you yourself come to shape and form what's happening. So maybe that's what I'm trying to emphasise. You don't need to sort of go away and invent the wheel all over again. Take advantage of what has happened before, but recognise that it's going to be affected by you. It will change its shape. It will change its form. So that's the point I'm making. It's sort of a continuity with change, I suppose.
I think in a way that, for me, is one of the most crucial areas that I need to look at, and maybe for other young Buddhists, is that issue of we find ourselves, you know, in a way moving into something that appears to already be set up. There are things running, there are institutions, and in a way, yes, we need to kind of take hold of them and use them and grow in them, but then at the same time, we need to then take them forward.
Yes.
So anyway, I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah.
If you've got any ideas or principles or tips that we can use.
Yeah. Well, in a way, I gave a tip in talking to you that there's an area of concern. Well, there certainly are order members who've taken that very seriously. And in fact, Guhyapati runs a training centre for activists, Buddhist activists, Eco-Dharma. That's what he does. He trains people in activism. Anyway, that's an example where you feel strongly about this. You're also a sincere Buddhist, and you're part of Tri Ratna. You presumably feel comfortable with Tri Ratna, but you're wanting to sort of explore an area that, as far as you're aware, hasn't been explored much. So I think that there's going to be always a delicate boundary, knife edge, as it were, between receptivity and creativity. I think you'll experience that. Any creative person experiences that. You know, there's Harold Bloom mentioned this, didn't he? The anxiety of influence. You know, so that many writers and artists and so forth, they are deeply influenced by those who went before. I saw that painting, that exhibition at the Tate last year of Turner and his influences. I don't know whether anybody else saw that. It's a very, very good exhibition. And you saw Turner painting like Rembrandt, painting like Claude, and so on. And he's sort of trying to you know, so overawed by the extraordinary grandeur of their achievement that it's difficult to find his own voice within that. And eventually you see him then rebelling against that, and ultimately you see him emerging with something that's absolutely distinctive and new. And I think that process is there for all of us in our creative lives, in other words, our Buddhist lives. We are influenced, we're strongly influenced, and that's great. Maybe without Rembrandt, there couldn't have been Turner. How would he have found his way? Without the Buddha, there couldn't have been, you know, the great beings of the past. Without his teachers, there couldn't have been Sangharakshita. Without Sangharakshita, there certainly couldn't have been Subhuti. And you need to sort of fully open up to those influences, but at the same time, you're kind of discovering your own place within that. And it's sometimes a quite difficult struggle. Sometimes you give up too much and, you know, you wander around being Sangharakshita. You know, all the first talks I gave, I told even the same jokes. I think that was quite a good thing to do, actually, because they were pretty good jokes. But it's okay to do that. And sometimes, you know, you're determinedly yourself. And if Sangharakshita says left, you say right. And if he says up, you say down. Which is just another kind of influence, actually. You don't really discover yourself in doing that. But it is, well, I thought the phrase anxiety of influence was quite a good one. That it's quite a sort of strange situation to be in, relation to people who you greatly admire and who've done so much, but who don't quite fit you, which they never can. And so you need to take full advantage of them and sort of rediscover what they've discovered for yourself. That will happen quite naturally. So I think you can have quite a lot of confidence in that process, that if you open yourself up to the great Buddhists of the past and you take full responsibility for yourself karmically, it'll all work itself out. Maybe you could say stream entry is at the point at which that struggle is finally resolved, because you don't need to make a struggle to take responsibility, because that happens spontaneously, and you don't have to make an effort to open up, because that's just operating naturally through you. But until that point, there's a delicate balance to be struck, which everybody will feel. And you can almost categorize people. I could almost look around the room and sort of predict. Maybe I'm being over there. Maybe I'm taking the V a bit too literally. But, you know, you can sort of see some people are more on the side of opening up, and some people are more on the side of asserting. It's inevitable. And you sort of find your balance within that. Karma and Dharma. I was aware Ivan was asking a question earlier, so we'll come, unless it's sort of along the same lines or what?
Well, it's very related to this.
Okay. Keep your question in mind. Yeah.
And, funny enough, I was more interested in as well in how you started seeing your talk, just the fact of having you in this building, and so this thing of you encouraging us to take this on board and kind of recreate the Dharma, not recreate the Dharma, but just keep it alive.
Keep it alive, yeah.
And especially being within this building, the LBC, and within Triratna. Last night, I heard from Kamal Shila, he was expressing this, the shape of Triratna. He was saying that, okay, our emphasis will come with other, in contrast or compared with other Buddhist movements. What makes us a bit different is our Bantist emphasis on Sangha and Kalyanamitra, arts and imagination as part of the spiritual practice. We have a particular system of meditation, and we have how we express the Dharma, probably ecumenically informed from other Buddhist traditions, based on a strong emphasis on going for refuge to the three jewels. And he mentions all, like, our emphasis on, or probably our expressing or exploring Dharma life throughout the nation. Yeah, I've always seen, like, all these things that I just said, like, yeah, it's that throughout now. But then he mentioned an ordination is the way that we express us, or we identify ourselves. It's a different ordination than in other movements. And you were saying a bit more of that, yeah, to go out, we need some training. So that's the kind of, in this area where I wonder if you can say a bit more about ordination and this training. And basically, in these three areas of young Buddhists and ordination training, ordination as spiritual death, and as well as ordination as the new society. I feel as well that it's a
bit it's a small topic you want me to.
Yeah.
Well, I can't comment on, on, I can't take off from what Commander Shula said, because I don't fully know what he said. But so ordination, what young people in ordination? Well, they should get ordained as quickly as possible. well, I suppose the first thing is that let's just place ordination in context. You know, I've been talking, stressing relational. The relational aspect of things, the Buddha himself existed in relation, and that your spiritual life is lived in relation. And ordination is a point in that deepening relationship. It's the point at which you step into a community of people who share an effective commitment to the three jewels, which has a very great effect on your own spiritual life. You come into a closer contact with others, a deeper connection with others, and your own spiritual life achieves a sort of firmness and determination. It's hard to communicate this if you haven't done it, but it makes a difference. Sometimes people say, well, why bother? You know, I can meditate and so forth. But in taking a step in ordination, there's a real change within you and a change in your relationship with others, which is hard to predict. You've probably got some flavour of it, those of you who've become mitras, or even when you ask for ordination, all these things make a difference. They almost restructure your sense of yourself. Well, they do restructure your sense of yourself. So when you are ordained, you're declaring, I am a being whose the basis of whose life is going for refuge to the three jewels. You're coming out as a one who goes for refuge to the three jewels. It's interesting in a way the comparison with that whole sort of sexual liberation language, the language of coming out. There is something of that, and I, you know, friends of mine who've come out as gay have told me that the huge difference that it makes, that they've sort of in saying, you know, I am gay, or whatever the phrase is that they might choose to express that through, it changes their relationship to the world, changes their relationship to themselves. So in being ordained, you change your relationship to yourself and to the world. And of course, you change your relationship to those who've changed their relationship, if you see what I mean. So that you step into a spiritual community in a very, very powerful way, which, you know, I can only say that do it and you'll believe me. Something very, very big changes. I remember that myself, my own ordination, nearly 40 years ago, 38 years ago. I remember just being overwhelmed by the sense that I didn't realise this was what I was doing. It's what I most wanted to do, but I just didn't realise it was what I was going to do. And it made a huge difference to me. And I strongly encourage people to take this step as young as you can. I think that our system is not sufficiently adapted to young people coming in. Banti just dropped cases over our necks like confetti. Well, it's gone all right, hasn't it? You know, I'd really like to see many more people ordained. Well, I was ordained when I was 24. I'd like to see many more people ordained at that sort of age. So I've been doing my best, using my influence, to try to get the process accelerated. And, you know, yeah, you're going to make a mess of it, that's for sure. Well, we did. I don't see why you shouldn't. But I think that the time to commit yourself is when you're young. It, you know, for me, it was a career move. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's like people do. You know, I wanted to get to the top. I did, actually. And then I resigned. But it's a bit, it's sort of, when you're, I don't think people do this anymore, but, you know, in my day, you used to have to decide what your career was going to be, what your life was going to be based upon, you know, what you were going to do, what you're going to do when you grow up. Perhaps not quite like that now, but that was the sort of decision you made. And I remember deciding myself at about the age of 16, I wasn't going to have a career. And that was a decision not to join the system, as it were. And when I came across the Tri Ratna, well, the FWBO as it was, and Bhante, I increasingly realised, this is what I'm going to do. And I'd really like others to do this, to have the privilege of doing what I did when I was young, and base my life upon it, base your lives upon it, so that everything else that you do has its place around that, you know, somewhere in that mandala. So your political activism or social activism is placed in the context of that. Whatever it is that you do is in that context. So, ordination, I think, is very, very significant. A step in spiritual life, but more than anything, you say it's a very, very significant step in life itself. You have a completely different relationship to life, different relationship to the world around you. Do it young, and then get things sort of sorted out. And it won't be easy, because you're young. You don't always understand yourself well. I'm just about beginning to understand myself at the age of 63. I wish I knew things now that I knew things then that I know now. But what a context to do it in. So that's the first thing. I don't know whether I've said what you wanted me to say.
Why can't I what you just said?
Okay. And then what was that? There were three things, weren't there? What was next?
Yeah, the other was around spiritual death.
Ah. Well, that's quite straightforward, really, that if you've attended my rambles over the last week, I'm talking about the Dharma Niyama and the Karma Niyama. Karma being those processes that are to do with self-awareness and taking responsibility, ethical responsibility. Dharma being processes that unfold when you get out of the way, creative forces that are implicit in reality itself that unfold when you get out of the way. And what you're doing is, in committing yourself and going for refuge effectively, is committing yourself to letting those processes unfold, to working at karma so that you become able to let go of self, and working to open up to dharma so that it becomes the dominant momentum within you, which is dying spiritually. That is letting go of identity, letting go of fixed views about yourself, you know, as English, such and such a class, such and such a gender, you know, belonging to this group or that group, you know, these social identity groups. I find that very interesting, you know, that you can sort of identify yourself on Facebook as such and such or such and such. I don't do it myself, I get Sam to do it. But, you know, you belong to that group. Your identity group, as it were. Will you let go of all that? Ultimately, you even let go of the idea of yourself as a human being. You let go of the idea of yourself as being bounded by one life. And that letting go of your identity in that way is an opening up to currents within the dharma, within life, the dharma currents within life that lead you ultimately to Buddhahood and beyond. So ordination is a point at which you commit yourself to spiritual death. Mm-hmm. And you commit yourself to dying spiritually. You effectively die. In other words, you constantly let go. Every time you react, you look at what it is in you that has reacted, you let go of it, ideally speaking. And every time you get fixed in some sort of identity, some sort of role, you let it go. At least eventually you let it go. So you're committed to letting go of identity, all identity, to being completely naked, completely open to the deepest currents within life. And you let those work through you. And ordination is a decisive commitment to that process of spiritual death. Still want to be ordained? Good. Another third one, new society.
New society.
Well, I think that's just really, it reflects back on many of the things I've said, that we need to, first of all, create an environment that supports our spiritual practice and even our activism. You're going to be a much better activist if you're in a community. And if you've got retreats to go on, you've got situations which will support you. So, yes, the new society notion is the creation, first of all, of an environment that helps us and supports us in our spiritual efforts. Secondly, it's the notion of creating that environment for the benefit of others who want to take decisive spiritual steps. But it goes beyond that, into your territory. It's the transformation of the whole of society so that it's one which supports people as human beings and supports their real human value, and that enables them to reveal their real human quality. Well, Dr. Ambedkar said that society, first of all, the duty of society is to provide justice and freedom, equality for everybody. But once that's achieved to any degree, the duty of society, the purpose of society, is the development of the individuals within it, cultural and spiritual development. So our work in this widest sense of new society is the confronting the injustices of things and the supporting of the positive forces within society, and the communication within society of the best human values, which ultimately are Dharma values. And I do think we need to do that far, far more. You know, getting into the belly of the beast and transmitting these values. We've got so much to say, even though we may not ourselves be brilliant and clear and all the rest of it. But because of the Dharma, so much that troubles the world, we've got a perspective on. You know, sometimes you find myself listening to the end of those programs like Any Questions, where they get a row of parliamentarians and they ask them questions. You know, sometimes there are some very intelligent and good answers, but quite often I'm sort of going, I've got the answer because of the Dhamma. I can see how to deal with that question. And not just by referring to categories that are drawn from the Dhamma, referring to categories that are familiar. So we need to be communicating in that sort of way within popular culture. So I think this is very, very important, and where, in a way, that the question of recreation comes up, you need to be dealing with these three elements, the setting for yourself, taking advantage of the work that I and others have done, setting for yourself of good conditions, the extension of those conditions so that your fellows, fellow young people can relate to them and can connect with them. And then, you know, taking those right out into societies as a whole and finding the places where they're most needed.
Just a quick question.
Well, let's see if there's a quick answer.
I'm trying to still formulate it in my head. But anyway, here goes. I was kind of... constantly been kind of covering the aspect of, well, interested in the aspect of, you know, non-judgment. And as soon as you, it's more like an existential problem. Like, you know, I was thinking about how to achieve a balance between, you know, being a Buddhist and out in the community. Or in the wider world. But, yeah, coming back to the idea of non-judgment, I was thinking as soon as you define something, so as soon as you say, like, oh, like if you're a Buddhist, or as soon as you say, or perhaps make it explicit, like, I find that you almost cut yourself off from, you can kind of cut yourself off from your purpose and doing so. And is it better just to have those values, like Buddhist values of like having an open heart and compassion, which is more about understanding other points of view, even if, you know, you don't necessarily agree with them, but just having the compassion. And in that way, you can have more of an impact as a Buddhist rather than living in a Buddhist community, which I think is a great thing.
Sure.
But I think it's quite,
I can understand the dilemma, yeah.
Is something that you cannot achieve. You cannot achieve through friends. And you also have circumstances, perhaps, that you don't choose, that are surrounding you. And you have to make do with, you know, what you have. Like everybody. So.
Yes.
I don't know, because you know all the time you're creating stories and.
I've got you. I've got your point. Yeah. Yes. But I think this is it is a real issue. And the way in which that's dealt with in Buddhism is to recognize that what you're talking about is a very lofty ideal. The Buddha himself describes himself as having no view. And so he approaches every situation absolutely freshly, without any preconception, he infallibly operates in a compassionate and appropriate way, but it's very difficult to achieve that, and one approaches that gradually. So in Buddhism, it's considered that you do need views, you need, even if you like, judgments, you need distinctions that will help you get to that point so that you can operate more and more freely within it. So the Buddha described the path as the penetration of the Dharma as being gradual. So the state of mind of complete non-judgment, and if I've understood you correctly, of no view, to be achieved bit by bit, slowly, slowly. And you need a supportive framework for doing that, because we live in amidst a world that is highly structured by judgments, with minds that are highly structured by judgments, even that are structured biologically with judgments, if you see what I mean. They're bred into us. These go very, very deep indeed. So what the Dharma as a path is a set of ideas, perspectives, views, practices, institutions that assist you in becoming free from ideas, institutions, practices, etc. So that's the way I resolve it. I need the support of a community. I cannot, even at my ripe age, I know that I cannot function without it. I can do it much more than I used to be able to, but I need to have the supportive framework of the Sangha, and I can be much, much more effective because of that. I need the framework of ideas, of views, of right view, a samaditti, that will help me to make ethical judgments. I can say that's skillful, that's unskillful. Of course, what I mean by skillful is it's that which approaches the non-judgmental, if you see what I mean. It's that action that the Buddha performs completely spontaneously without view, but I need the framework of distinction in order to get nearer and nearer to that. So I think it's important to both retain the aspiration and the vision that you have, and to be constantly aware that we don't want to create a bad version of a bad system. Do you see what I mean? That we create in Buddhism another prison, that by creating a system of ideas and a system of practice, set of institutions, we just create a kind of, another kind of prison. And that happens. That happens to spiritual group. It happens within Tri Ratna. I've done it. I've been in it. At times it's been quite bad. It's bound to. You don't solve it by dissolving them, because actually you're still carrying those judgments around with you, even the judgment of a judgment and a non-judgment. The way I think of it is that one needs to retain a strong ideal of being ultimately free from all judgments, free from all effort, free from all will, free from all program, free from all idea of doing something, even free from all idea of not doing something. That's our ultimate goal. But to get there, you need the key distinctions between what is skillful, what is unskillful, what helps you, what doesn't help you. You need constantly to investigate that against natural human morality. Do you see what I mean? The Buddha says this, doesn't he? That you know of yourself whether these things are good or bad, whether they're harmful or non-harmful. And again, in Hungary, after the Second World War, what you saw was that the notions of good and bad were taken away, and they were distorted by a system, which was all to create the ideal society. So we don't want to do that. And at times we've done that. But what you know in the end, this is not human. This is harmful to this human being or that human being. I don't know whether this is helpful, but I think it is a very, very important issue, recognizing that ultimately we do need to go beyond all the categories and distinctions and ideas of practice and non-practice. But to get there, you need a framework. I remember this very strongly in my early days of practice.
Like you said, when you have logic and people just reason with their heads and
yes.
their hearts,
sure.
That's when the atrocities occur.
Yes, indeed.
They're not using their heart.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Well, so in a good system of practice will have a strong emphasis on metta. Do you see what I mean? It'll strongly, ultimately base itself upon human feeling, a human interrelationship. And that's what you have to judge Tri Ratna by. Do you see that is the predominant tone of it or not, if you see what I mean? And you won't find it's perfect. You'll find it at times used in a restrictive and, as you put it, brains imposing upon experience. As people were doing in the book that I'm reading, arguing black is white and white is black and convincing yourself of it. But real human feeling surmounts that. But I think it's an extremely important point. But what I will say is that my own experience is that after many years of practice, I feel less and less need for structures. You know what I mean? I feel freer and freer of ideas. I feel freer and freer of institutions and practices. I value those highly. I still get benefit from them, but I don't feel that they limit or restrict me at all. But I think that's to be achieved gradually and realistically. See where you're at. To what extent can you really live free from that? And don't, well, overestimate yourself, but be honest when it goes flat in your face, you fall flat in your face. You only discover by trying. But it's a key issue. And what I find about Buddhism, that it resolves this dilemma of duality, non-duality. For me. Okay, you've got the last word, sir. Well, no, I got it, actually.
I think, just to say to an earlier point of what you mentioned, that unfortunately, not all of us have got over Catholic upbringings.
Okay.
So, I'm afraid some of us
okay.
still have
an idealised view.
Some
I have
of
got.
Those.
Yes,
issues.
Of course. Yeah.
My question is that I feel for me part of the there's like an inherent danger for me in thinking of the spiritual as higher.
Ah, right.
And that therefore,
yeah.
the worldly, the sexual,
sure.
is lower, and
yeah.
therefore
yeah, yeah.
bad.
Yeah.
And guilt
sure.
is definitely still something that I, for one, deal with.
The what? Sorry,
guilt.
Yeah.
is still something that
okay.
you know, it's not.
Yeah.
I don't exist in a
idealized world that I seem to have talked
yeah.
about. Yeah. Maybe nobody does.
And I think when I mean, I've only recently started coming here, but I don't feel that is. Express that much, and maybe if you could talk a bit about a skillful way of perhaps dealing with that, because I think that I was talking to someone during the tea break. There's for me this what tends to happen is that while part of me might recognise that something is harmful to myself. The act of repressing that
sure.
doesn't actually solve
yeah.
it. So
yeah.
There's a bodily need to express it, and then a kind of maybe there's a ethical soul need to not have that, or a desire to not have that, but it's still there.
Yes, there are many different angles of approach one could take. The first thing is there's nothing wrong with sex. It's not everything, but it's all right. But I think the issue is dealt with in Buddhism in terms of mindfulness. So it's recognizing what's going on within yourself. And you've got a physical being, and you need food. Hunger is not a wrong thing. You have sexual responses, and they're fine. The problem is that they get tangled up, don't they, in longings for things that you probably can't satisfy through that. If sex is carried out in a human way, in other words, with a recognition of the humanity of the other person and with decency, you have as much fun as you like. The problem is that it gets tangled up with self-view. So that's the issue, not sex. I remember Sangharakshita saying very early on, if sex grew on trees, there'd be no problem. It just might get over full, that's all. But the problem is that it has to do with other people. Of course, you could also say that's the wonderful thing about it, because it brings you into close, intimate relations with others. But the trouble is that you start getting, beginning to rely on the other for your own sense of well-being. It's not that that's bad, it's just that sooner or later that's going to be painful. In Buddhism there's never this judgment of good and bad. There's more, the judgment is skillful or unskillful. It's meant quite literally. It's what actually leads to your or others' harm or benefit. So yes, sex need not harm at all. In the end, one will transcend it. But it's not, I did practice celibacy for quite a long time, but I just concluded in the end that I wasn't transcending it in that way. So I'm practicing it for all it's worth. No, but I've still got time. joking apart. If I said it'll drop off by itself, that could be misinterpreted. It's not a big deal. It really isn't. It is a big deal because it's been made a big deal. And it takes time to get it into proportion and to discover it. But don't worry about it too much. And just notice what's going on within you. Notice your body, what's going on in your body. Notice your feelings. And don't, in the first place, judge them. If something's painful, it's painful. If it's pleasant, it's pleasant. Of course, where you need to start introducing a notion of distinction is when it comes to action. It's not necessarily impulse even, it's action. When it comes to what you do, then you need to discriminate, because you need to decide what is going to be beneficial to you, what is going to be harmful to you, and what is going to be beneficial or harmful to others. So I think that the element of acceptance of you as you are comes in mindfulness, this stress on mindfulness, accepting that whatever the states are as whatever they are. Discrimination does need to be used, because it's not a question of just accepting everything, because you have impulses and thoughts and strategies that can be very, very harmful. But the raw sensations, the raw emotions, even the raw impulses, they're just what they are. They're conditioned by previous samskaras, previous actions. As a recovering Catholic, you have to sort of accept that a lot of what a doctrine tells you is sinful is merely normal, is merely human, and moderately enjoyable and pleasurable if acted upon. But it can be very deeply ingrained. I mean, James Joyce, The Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. It's a wonderful, wonderful description of the sermon in which they're taught hellfire, and the artist, decides he's just going to have nothing to do with sex ever again, and immediately goes to a prostitute. And it's just, the two go together. The suppression and the unwholesome, well, maybe unwholesome expression, go together. So, one has to just get things back into proportion, which is not an easy thing to do. I don't know if this is it's such a generalized discussion, but I think that in Buddhism, what you described about as coming back into the body is represented by the emphasis on mindfulness. And mindfulness not as, kind of heavy slowing down of everything and, judging, but simply an acceptance of the plain basic reality. And an enjoyment of it, an enjoyment of the movement of your body, an enjoyment of even sexual feelings. Of course, also a feeling of the pain of them at times, what they lead to and where they take you. Keeping your discrimination for harm, as it were. Do you see what I mean? And that harm in quite immediately recognizable terms, not in what God says or even what you think Buddhism says, but in your own direct perception of what leads to suffering. So yes, if you've not heard this dimension of things, maybe that's where you need to look at it, look for it. It's in just accepting the reality of your embodiedness. And it's one of the things I like about Sangharakshita, that he's very unguilty never sort of encouraged that sort of guilt. Although, he said things that I've turned into guilt, because one has an infinite capacity for it if you've been conditioned to it. But, you know, also my contact with him has freed me from it. Of course, you know, the Catholic Church has not survived for 2,000 years to be wiped out in a generation by, you know, an act of Parliament. It continues, and I have a brother who's a Catholic priest. I've seen his struggles. He's a good bloke. I like him. Anyway, that's probably enough. So, of course, we've touched on some very, very important areas. In fact, I think to the end part of what we were talking about, a lot more to say there. Very, very important, interesting.